to pass away. For life presents such possibilities each and every day. I heard a calling that was right for me. I prayed for strength for what's ahead of me. Show me the way. Please show me the way. The sun rose high and felt the night away. Who stood before me was my enemy. Come to take away my liberties. I'd rather die than be a slave to thee. Don't treat me this way. I'd rather die than be your slave. I will survive. Can you feel my rage? It's not a question. Killed my brothers, they lay dead by me. We hit them hard, we made them pay that day. We hung the traitors from the highest trees. Mercy from me. Lost a lot, our pain was heavy. Sacrifice for God and country.
No more coming.
He held the ground that was in front of me. This was the price to pay for liberty.
Still you hear me say, I'd rather die than be your slave. I will survive.
This is Truth Quest with Melody, and see if that's coming in a little bit better. And tonight, this is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. We are streamed on the Internet at khen.org. If you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, They are now available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from our KHEN.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our guest is Bruce Woodhull with Otero Forum. And are you there, Eric and Bruce?
Okay, Bruce and Eric, we've got you.
I'm here.
Okay, and Eric, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, let's go ahead and just get started here. And I've got as my guest tonight, our guest tonight, is Bruce Woodhull and Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And we were trying to try some new technology, which worked last week, but this week it's kind of giving us some fits. So, Dr. Carlstrom, Bruce, let me ask you to do a brief description of what you do and how you've been affiliated with the Otero Forum and how you got into working with property rights issues.
Well, I co-administer a blog called the Otero Residence Forum. It's out of Alamogordo, New Mexico. And I got involved in 2007, about a year ago. In fact, tomorrow the blog will be a year old. I started, I believe, on August 6th of last year. I got involved with the designation of White Sands National Monument as a World Heritage Site by UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. UNESCO was started by Sir Julian Huxley, and maybe some other time we can do a show on that guy, interesting individual. We don't want, the residents down here, we're divided on it, but I'm with a group of people that don't want to see White Sands National Monument designated a World Heritage Site, because for one, we believe it doesn't need it. They say it adds a layer of extra layer of protection to preserving the site, this particular site of gypsum sand or silicone sand or whatever it is, it's White Sands out there. But they implement buffer zones on the adjacent areas. This is a non-voted on, uncontrolled entity coming into our county, and along with the buffer zone comes a number of globalist interpretations of what should be a sustainable development for the community and for the environment. And I think that's a sovereign issue for the residents of New Mexico, particularly the residents of Otero County, something not to be decided by UNESCO and their committees. In 2002, they had a World Heritage Site Convention in Ferraro, Italy, where they plainly wrote out and published they said they would manipulate, do away with, change, whatever it took, local ordinances and laws to implement a buffer zone and then to go ahead and implement rigid regulations on, you know, affecting the environment, housing, populations, a number of things like that. So we started the blog protesting, or, you know, opposition. We formed opposition against this World Heritage Site designation. It's gone from that to private property rights, protecting private property rights, to working with ranchers in Canton and Sierra County with the wolf reintroduction, which has just been a disaster out there. We're not anti-wolf, we're not anti-animal, we're anti-surrogate species to fraudulently expand the authority and jurisdiction of the federal government. I'm working with a woman in Washington State, a very courageous woman, who's fighting the Columbia Land Trust, who has altered waterways adjacent to her land and has flooded her house, killed her livestock and her pets for the last 5 years. And that county and that state attorney general will do nothing to stop that. It's driven by what we call NGOs, non-governmental organizations, who are masquerading as environmental groups, but it has nothing to do with the environment. They're destroying the environment. They're forcing people off their land, and they're snatching this land up. We filed in Joaquim County Superior Court today in Washington State. I had constructed a writ of mandamus for this woman, and we'll see where it goes from there. The writ of mandamus goes to a higher authority, a higher court over the sheriff, orders the sheriff to do his fiduciary duty and enforce county ordinance to stop this flooding. Not only her property, but other property owners are being forced off their land. So that kind of gives you a brief overview of what I do. I got involved with Melody. She, you sent me an email. We started corresponding through the email. I guess you saw the blog or something. Was that how we met?
You know, it's been so.
Right.
So
yeah.
That's probably how.
Yeah, the blog is co-administered by different people. We have different political views on there. We have Karen who describes herself as an old hippie, and we have Janet, who's the bulldog of the group, Janet White. She's very involved in local issues, and she holds our county commissioners. She holds their feet to the fire. And then I am involved with people around the United States that have stumbled on the blog and have requested help with their private property things. I don't do this on a political basis. I don't care if you're a conservative or a liberal, who you're going to vote for. It's not a political issue, even though politicians will exploit this on either side of the debate. They'll try to get their self-worth at the expense of others. We don't do that here. What we're trying to do here is let the sovereigns of the different states in the United States, down to counties, make these decisions. If they want to make decisions along environmental lines, how their environment will be protected, development, whatever, that should be the decision of the people in that area. Like your issue, Melody, with the drilling. What was it, Lexion, or what was the name of that company?
I think Dr. Carlstrom's probably a little bit more of an expert on this. Are you there, Eric?
Yeah, we don't have a blog. What we have here in Crestone, Colorado, is right now about three groups that are working to try. Well, the groups have slightly different emphases. I'm part of a group called Water Watch Alliance, and I have a website which is basically informative. And we've taken the position that we'd like to see this pristine valley stay and no gas and oil drilling zone or no-go zone. The other two groups are San Luis Valley Ecosystem Council and the San Luis Valley Citizens Alliance, and they are taking more of an approach to let's mitigate the damage, let's make sure an environmental impact statement is done. But you know, I'm fascinated with your issue, your strategy of having a blog. I've read it a few times and have been very impressed with the people and the ideas and the articles that you've come up with. Could you explain a little bit how that works and how many people are contributing to that?
The blog itself at times can be very irreverent. You've probably noticed that. We don't pull punches. We have community members that send us information, everything from upcoming meetings with the county commissioners, the fish and game, the national or the Department of Interior, whatever, to people that express their opinions or news items, and then we make those available. We try to mobilize people to attend county commissioner meetings or grazing association meetings, things like that, to learn and basically to educate people on why these issues are important and why we would be losing our property rights and our ability to vote on these things. If you kind of cruise or surf the blog and you see the what we call labels, we have, I don't know, probably over 500 labels there and other links that will take you to other information, how other people are fighting this and how other people are dealing with the gradual loss of sovereignty in the United States. We've been accused of being constitutionalists or black helicopter theorists, and that is the obstruction tactics or strategy that the opposition puts up to kind of dilute our credibility. But the fact is that as we lose our sovereigns as republics, the different states, as we lose that sovereignty and turn that over to the corporate United States or the fraudulent authority, expansion of authority and jurisdiction, then we ourselves, we don't need elected, you know, registered electors anymore. We don't need voters. We simply just kind of become pawns in the system. We pay our taxes, and like Ron Paul says, you know, we watch the circus while the bad stuff's going on in the background. If we can educate one person or two people and they can take it out to other people, then that's our goal, as well as taking care of our own backyard. We don't so much insert ourselves into other situations as particularly me. I do most of the stuff outside the county, outside the state of New Mexico, through correspondence, email or snail mail. But we try to educate people and make them aware of this. And it comes down basically to voting for the right candidate at the local level and making sure your county commissioners, your county sheriff, your elected officials maintain the oath they took under state statute. I was reading this letter that Melody had sent me from this guy at Nestle's. Nestle's wants to take the water from the Arkansas River, pipe it down to the highway, and sell it in Denver in bottles.
No, they've got their own spring, and what they're going to do is they're augmenting the water from the Arkansas.
Okay. This is a classic letter. This is a very good example of what we see on a weekly basis. There's some code words in here, and it kind of dances around the main issue. Anything to do with water in the state of Colorado, let me read the one thing that caught my attention before I talk about your water rights. In this letter from this Bruce Lauerman, he's the natural resources manager for Nestle's Waters North America, he says, "We expect to submit permit applications to Chaffee County soon and look forward to the process to demonstrate Nestle Waters' commitment to doing the project right by identifying and mitigating potential adverse impacts. Our preliminary scientific research indicates this will be a low-impact project." Okay, right off the bat, Chaffee County commissioners don't have any say, have no authority over water in Colorado. I believe you have 7 water court districts, which means you have 7 water judges and 7 water referees that adjudicate and sometimes mitigate disputes or authorize the beneficial use of water, new drills, new taps, whatever, outside certain municipal areas. And that's easy to research. That would be in your revised statutes under your constitution. The thing that jumps out to me is his preliminary claim of preliminary scientific research. I would like to see the preliminary scientific research. I would like to see what's called a QAP, which is a document prepared prior to any environmental impact statement. Those are the things that need to be identified immediately by the locals in the community to see if these guys are playing by the rules.
Just to give you the recent update on what's going on here, there were 2 court cases here that affected our valley. One was having to do with a challenge by Gary Boyce, who's tried to take the water out of the San Luis Valley and pump it over to the Denver area, making billions of dollars. And water court ruled that all of the water in the valley was already allocated, therefore he couldn't export this water. But then a recent case, I just read today that the other case, the water judge ruled that the Great Sand Dunes National Park had also made a challenge for the water, saying that they need water to maintain the park sand dunes, and therefore they would like to claim all unallocated water in the valley, any unallocated water that appears for the U.S. government. And this was supposed to take several weeks, and what happened was it took only 3 days, apparently, because they decided at the end, and this comes in the last paragraph or two, they decided that they would not consider any potential future injuries that this decision might cause. And apparently right after the decision was made, they played some song in the courthouse, which was the theme song of the Sand Dunes or something. So it was considered a great victory for Mother Earth and all human beings, I guess. But I'm not enough of a water expert to know, but I have been around Melody and talked about these things long enough to know that there's some real issues with World Heritage Sites and National Heritage Areas and Agenda 21 that have to do with securing control of public resources, commons, you might say, including water, which of course is going to be one of the most valuable. And how this might play out in the future, they decide not to address in the lawsuit. And this is where I would be very curious to hear what you think about that ruling.
We have a similar thing going on down here with the Department of Interior and water, I believe water under White Sands National Monument. We have an aquifer of salt water. The salt water here holds the fresh water, according to the state hydrologist, in the mountains and part of the basin. The salt water holds it up into the mountains, while we at one time had a lot of water in the mountains. As I've seen in Africa and in Brazil with the plantings of trees to dry up water to take it away from villages and stuff, and then as villages dry up, move out, the land is purchased by a sovereign wealth fund, a foreign entity that backs foundations that finance or fund the non-governmental organization, liaison organization of the United Nations. This gets down to this facade of Agenda 21, the Law of the Sea Treaty, the Rio Convention of 92, of saving the world for environmental purposes and for humanity. What essentially is happening is the shifting of populations off their land, and the land is purchased. Look for things like sovereign wealth funds. And you know what a sovereign wealth fund is, someone that accumulates debt or buys assets in the United States or, you know, a foreign country. They have ownership of these things. Essentially what is happening is, it comes down to a nutshell, our national parks, our national monuments, our natural resources are being used as collateral against our national debt. And one of the ways they disguise this is the selling of land, the reallocation of resources like water, and then the gradual dehabitation of these areas. This is no joke. At one time, people thought, well, this is the black helicopter, the conspiratorial stuff. And they do this under the banner of environmentalism. I think we all want to see a sound environmental policy, but it exploits countercultural ideals and the secular beliefs that there's a right wing and a left wing, and it permeates just about all aspects of our culture. But what it doesn't do is provide for us, for our children, our grandchildren in the future. It takes away their ability to control the environment, to control the water allocation, to own land, and to vote on these issues. And Melody's right, you know, when she talks about Agenda 21 or the Law of the Sea Treaty, which we call LOST, that's exactly what's happening. That's what I believe is happening in Washington. This is a tidal community up there. The Columbia Land Trust up there has granted anybody that lives in a coastal area can bring charges through the Columbia Land Trust against another resident without going through state statutes, the Attorney General, or the county sheriff. This is a non-governmental organization. Who gives them the authority to claim jurisdiction and authority and basically adjudicate through a foundation probably funded out of the country somewhere? Do you see how that works?
Absolutely. Bruce, before we go further, could you give the web address of your forum just for our visitors or our listeners who might want to visit that, and then I will give the web address of my website that deals with some of these issues as well.
Okay, if you just go to Google and type in the search engine, Otero Residence Forum, it will take you to it. That's the easiest way to get it, because it's like HTTP.
Okay, and so could I add to that if I wanted to?
Post on the blog?
Could be kind of, yeah.
Would you like to submit
well,
things?
I'm just wondering how it works. You'll have to excuse me. I'm a little bit in the dinosaur era here. I haven't worked with blogs before. If I see something interesting in your blog, and I'm just John Q. Public up here in Colorado, and I want to, respond to it, how do I do that?
Okay, there are comments. First of all, you have to register with the blog. Is you just go the
okay?
You know, you type in your email and address or a password and stuff like that. That's easy. Or and then you can leave a comment under any one of the posts. But if you want to submit to the blog, I can arrange that. What I have people do is email it to me, and then I post it on the blog for them. So anything
okay, so
that
we want to post something, email to you.
Right.
Do you want to give that address, or can we get that off the blog?
I'll give it to you right now.
Okay.
It's bjwoodhull@msn.com.
Okay. Very good. That's good. I think it's a great idea. Now, my website is mostly an informational website, and it's a Google Pages website. It's free. So the address is http://waterwatchalliance.googlepages.com. That's http://waterwatchalliance, which is the name of our group, .googlepages.com. And I just finished writing an article called Green Global Dictatorship, Regional Governance Agenda 21, Sustainable Development, and the Wildlands Project, where I deal with these issues of the UN agenda for the 21st century, which Bruce is talking about, and how the designation of World Heritage Sites all over the world could be looked at as a kind of an incremental step towards UN, United Nations control, which would be, of course, a form of world government, which would then preempt and cut out the role of the United States government, the state's government, and the county government. So this is certainly what you're fighting. Now, I'm fascinated with your comment about the national parks, the World Heritage Sites, et cetera, are now being used as collateral against the national debt. Can you give me some proof, some evidence, some examples of that?
Yeah, I forget the guy's name. I forget the guy's name. I want to say James Baker. And if Janet White was here, she'd probably be saying, yeah, I believe it was Baker. Guys from the Reagan administration sounded the alarm on this back in the late 80s and the early 90s that this was being done. And we need to, for one, lower the national debt and put limits on what we allow foreign entities to own and control in the United States. I think it was Baker that said that. I don't have my my notes on that up because I've been studying Chaffee County and the Nestle's thing all day, as well as working on another thing for Otero County. I can get that information to Melody or to you, Doctor, and you can take it from there. Go ahead.
Pardon me? And I was just going to say that the national debt now for our listeners is $9 trillion. And, you know, there was a study recently, some environmental group in Johannesburg actually estimated the total value of all the assets in nature, forests, air, water, minerals, et cetera, at somewhere between $21 trillion and $51 trillion, which, of course, is absurd. Calculation on the face of it, because, you know, without these assets, nothing can live. Therefore, you couldn't have any economics of any kind. But consider if they think the whole world resources are worth somewhere between 21 and 51 trillion, this country by itself has a debt of 9 trillion. So this would put us in great jeopardy then for this kind of a buyout. And in fact, we have seen in California the U.S. Forest Service selling off Forest Service land, which happened to be right near Sierra Pacific Industries operations, just conveniently for Sierra Pacific Industries, which is the largest landowner in California. We've seen the BLM sell off plots of land surrounding Las Vegas, which, of course, are quite valuable. So we've already seen the process of the sell-off of American public land, which we could look at as the common. So I personally think this is an enormously important issue. There's a tremendous amount of wealth involved in the public lands in America.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Ron Ardle wrote a really good book. Let me see, I'm sitting here. Ron Ardle and a guy named Nathan Tabor. Nathan Tabor wrote a book called The Beast on the East River, where he goes into detail on the makings of the United Nations. Your own Mountain Legal States Foundation in Colorado, Warriors for the West, a great book by Pendley, where these guys, Undue Influence is the book by Ron Ardle. And I tell people to read books because the story is out there. It's not conspiratorial. It's out there, and it's a very valid thing that's happening. Learn the laws. When you fight these people, you want to fight them in your state and district courts. You don't want to be goaded into a federal jurisdiction by a fraudulent citation. Learn your jurisdiction. Learn how to move the courts. Learn how to state your claims, state your rights, and that's all under your state constitution and your revised statutes. And you can start there.
Could you read those books again, Bruce?
Sure. A really good one is by Nathan Tabor, and it's called The Beast on the East River.
Okay.
And then Ron Ardle.
The East River.
Yeah, The Beast on the East River. The other one is Undue Influence by Ron Ardle.
Okay.
And then Warriors for the West by, his last name is Pendley. I get an email from him every now and then, or I'm on their mailing list, from the Mountain States Legal Foundation. In fact, Melody, I had just ordered some stuff from the Southwestern Center for Land Grant Studies. Because remember I told you one of the things I'd look at was historic land grants and how they affect it. To see, I don't think you're in it, but Chaffee County might, part of Chaffee County might be under the Treaty de Guadalupe del Lago.
Now, would the Baca Grande have been in that?
I'm sorry?
Would the Baca Grande have been in that?
I'll find out.
Okay.
Because I was researching where I could get that, and I found a site that's willing to give that stuff up, so I went ahead and sent off for it. And that will be that may be, I can't guarantee anything, but may be something to look at, because we've certainly cited the Treaty of Guadalupe del Lago in our claims to sovereign authority over our county land, our state land.
And what kind of effects are you getting with the work that you're doing?
I haven't seen any response from any of the big globalist things, because they don't acknowledge, they just continue to do it. Locally here, our county commissioners, and we put the pressure on them, they passed an ordinance banning a World Heritage Site within the county, because you have to remember, the United States, the corporate United States, doesn't own the land that White Sands National Monument or even Holloman Air Force Base down here sits on. You know, we did not cede jurisdiction of that land. They use the land, they have authority over the land, but it's not their land. It still belongs to the sovereigns of New Mexico. Probably the same with the land where the pristine land with the water and the lakes you're talking about, Doctor, that they want to drill through to get the natural gas. I'm thinking
that's the Baca National Wildlife Refuge. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking that land belongs to the people of Colorado and not to the BLM or the National Park. The Forest Service, our national forests are actually state reserves, state reserve forests administered by the USDA and the Forest Service, not owned by the federal government.
So how are they working?
Can you give us a reference on that?
I got that information from the New Mexico State Constitution. And it's a 1959 revision of a statute clarifying that the forests, there's state forests and then there's federal forests. The federal forests are actually state forests held in reserve to be administered by the USDA and the Forest Service. I'm betting you have the same type of statute in the Colorado revised statutes under your constitution, under one of your articles.
So is BLM state or federal?
Bureau of Land Management would probably be the same, but you're going to have to check that out to see what they own. Is what they own as opposed to what they administer. Okay. Does that make sense?
Right, right.
And it's a parcel by parcel. It's a county by county search.
So, have you found anything? Are you getting many areas down in New Mexico where they're trying to deem them as national heritage areas?
We have. Let me see. Carlsbad Caverns is a World Heritage Site now.
No, not World Heritage. I'm saying national.
National Heritage. No, I don't believe New Mexico has. Maybe up by Santa Fe. I don't know. I haven't seen in New Mexico the advent of national heritage sites.
I believe, Bruce, that there is one, and it does extend from Taos to Santa Fe and takes up a huge chunk of northern New Mexico. I've seen it on the maps of national heritage areas. All you need to do is Google national heritage areas, and there are some maps that show where they are and when they were included in the national heritage areas. Of course, some of them are still proposed and have not been voted on, but what you see is a trend where in the last several years the national heritage areas that are proposed and approved are very, very, very large chunks of land, and they're in the west.
Yeah, maybe we can exchange information on that, because I had proposed to the descendants of the historic land grants in northern New Mexico that they start looking at designating these villages, that some of them go back to the like 1580, as sacred sites similar to Native American sacred sites, because the historic land grants were granted in the combination of these tesoros. The tesoros is a treasure in the spirit of these tesoros by the church and by the governor, and then by the guy that ran Mexico. Was he an emperor or a king back then? But it was based in religion, and these religious traditions have carried on throughout the years. In northern New Mexico, the environmentalists, I believe it was the Forest Guardians, are trying to move these people off these historic land grants. This is a unique culture, a unique population in New Mexico that has been there for almost 400 years, and we're going to move them off to preserve that forest. Yet you got a guy like Ted Turner that owns, 600,000 acres in his Vermijo ranch, where he drills for natural gas. He harvests his timber. He grazes bison and cattle in the forest, all the things that they're trying to ban or have banned in New Mexico, you know, grazing on public lands. He does all that, sells that on the open market, yet he funds these foundations that drive these NGOs that file the lawsuits, like the Forest Guardians, which are now, I think, the Wild Earth Guardians, to stop the states and the counties from exploiting these resources as they see fit within their own jurisdiction, within their claim to sovereignty. These lawsuits take that sovereignty away. So the guy that's got a lot of the money that funds a lot of these, that is making a lot of these, he funds a lot of these issues and these agendas to take this away from the more common people, the rural people, he does that himself on his land. Ranchers and loggers are not bad people, but they don't have coffee table environmental and coffee table books sitting in their house in their covenant-controlled neighborhoods in Denver or Albuquerque, Santa Fe. They're out there actually working the land, and they've been protecting and working that land for generations, as have the historic land grantees and their descendants in northern New Mexico, and now the push is to move them out. So I'm glad you told me that. I'd like to see that information, Doctor.
Yeah, actually, I can tell you it's on the article that's on my website, and I'll give you the address for that particular article. It's http://waterwatchalliance.googlepages.com, which is what I gave you, and then just /agenda21. And I was just looking at the map here, and it's a large segment of northern New Mexico. It's the number 36 of the heritage areas in the country, and that means it's the most recent one. so it's a very new one.
Great, I'd like to see that. And the thing is, I had contacted those people up there. Initially, they expressed some interest in it, then I never heard from them again. But they have been very successful in fighting the environmentalists on their own. I think they have a newsletter called the Jicarilla newsletter or journal or something that comes out monthly. I went through, I think, 10 years of that to study their strategy, you know, of that newsletter. It's online, and it's you can read it by month per year. And I went through all of them reading their strategy and how they fought these guys, the Forest Service, the environmentalists, and they're still holding on to their land.
Ultimately, what you're...
It's a difficult realization for me. I've never been a radical environmentalist, you know, but I've always been an environmentalist in temperament because I'm a hiker and a climber and a skier and outdoorsman, and I love nature. But it has come to my attention over the last year that the radical environmental movement has been co-opted by globalists who are using it to control resources, not for nature, but for themselves. And you know, now the environmental movement has been co-opted, has been sold out in many respects. And I think, I hope that a lot of environmentalists will wake up to this fact and realize that, you know, protecting nature is one thing and giving up our sovereign rights to private property and our civil liberties is something completely different.
You're right, because the environmental movement that seeks to protect the environment, they're going to lose the ability to do that, along with the ability of people that develop or drill wells or build highways. I don't think every house has to be built. I don't think every drill has to be, or every well has to be drilled. But as they lose their ability to develop the West or lands throughout the United States, the environmentalists are going to lose their ability to help preserve the wildlands. And you'd think, well, if the Rewilding Institute wants to let it all go and let it go back to nature, that's not what's going to happen. It's going to be populated by someone, and it's not going to be us. And the exploitation of those minerals and whatever else is underneath that land is going to be done. We're seeing in Africa right now the shift of hunter and gatherer populations like the Nuer in Kenya to coastal regions because they've dried up their water. They did it in Brazil. The people down there that lived in these villages, the UNESCO came in with a big corporate entity and planted trees. And I forget what the trees were for, but they planted tens and thousands of these trees and dried up the aquifer and the streams that these people had lived on for generations and moved them out. But the same company is deforesting the rainforest at an alarming rate. This is the same corporate entity. So you see how that works?
So they think that they're planting in one continent and they're deforesting in another, or is this all being done in Africa?
Well, this is the deforesting and the planting of trees was done in Brazil.
Okay.
What they did with the hunter-gatherers in Africa was they educated them. They thought they had educated them, took away their ability to trade in cattle. Cattle was like their source of their monetary value. They didn't have money, so to speak, but a family's wealth was measured in cattle. They took away their ability. They took away their access to water. They took away the cattle, and they're moving these tribes of hunters and gatherers, nomadic people, to coastal areas to basically become slave laborers in these industries that exploit the minerals and the lands of Africa. And we've seen what a tragedy it's been with the United Nations trying to prevent genocide in Africa, let alone taking control of these people's lives, taking their traditional livelihoods away, and moving them off the coast to become to live in urban slums, and with a culture they're not familiar with, and they're not going to do well with. And you know, it's like that generation will die off, the next generation will be more apt to live in the urban areas and want to get jobs and work for slave wages for these big corporate monstrosities that are raping Africa. The Monsanto the genetically modified grains that are resilient to the Roundup pesticide, but they don't reproduce. You know, they can't be pollinated by bees. And then the bees get into this pollen, and there's a bacterium that created the protein that make these genetically modified grains, like corn is one of them. I don't think sorghum is.
Soy.
But anyway, it kills the bees. They're killing our honeybees with this global dominance of agriculture, populations, and mineral wealth.
Well, you know.
Yeah, it is a global process. So what we see happening in Africa and Brazil today, it could well happen here. In fact, it is. Some of the maps that you see with the Biodiversity and Wildlands Project show proposal of the Wildlands Project to take at least 50% of the American land, that is to say, much of that away from the American people, and lock it up into core areas, core reserves, buffer zones around them. And then you'd have the remaining 50% with restricted human use, which would include human settlements. So the ultimate plan of the United Nations is to pack most of the poor Americans, of course we'll all be poor if this happens, into these large settlement areas, and then we would essentially be slaves and serfs again, because we would have lost our Bill of Rights and civil liberties. So, you know, this stuff is important to look at. These are plans that are being made by the United Nations and that are being implemented elsewhere in the world. And Dr. Michael Kaufman has put together the maps that come from these proposals, these Wildlands Project proposals, which is also which is featured in the UN Biodiversity Treaty of 1992, which Michael Kaufman was successful in getting the Senate not to approve. But still, our government has gone ahead with implementing many of these features. And, of course, World Heritage Sites, national parks, such as Yellowstone, these would become the core areas that would be completely off-limits then in the future to humans. And the rationale would be that nature needs this, you know, to keep the large ungulates in good shape and these populations. And I do believe lots of good biologists have been working on this in good faith. They just don't understand that the people in charge really don't care that much about the big ungulates. They just care about controlling the land.
If you can remember this term, pioneer investors started the United Nations. Okay, it wasn't an environmentalist, it wasn't a scientist, it wasn't a humanitarian, it was pioneer investors.
Now, was this the one that was a mutual fund?
I'm sorry?
Was this one that was a mutual fund, pioneer mutual funds?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I just know that in their original charter that was revised from like 1945 to 1948, like World War II never stopped as far as the dominance. It just went from bombs and machine guns to documents and attacks on sovereignty. And it was started by pioneer investors that wanted to realize this more efficient means of exploiting the resources of the world for a very small group of people, and the rest of us would essentially work for them. War does not make money for them, but war is an efficient way of diminishing attriting the population to a manageable size. And what Dr. Carlson is talking about as far as the Rewilding Institute and things like that, that's real. Underlying that, I believe, is the grab for the mineral wealth and water rights to sustain an economy of some sort. Because whether we like it or not, we can't live without these multinational conglomerates, because we're tied into them with the economics. If we had the ability to manipulate markets and compete with them as almost like a national union of consumers, and start once again manufacturing in this country, we could probably have more a better chance of fighting this. But the more that we don't produce in this country, the more that we lose those jobs, and we have a population of people that basically aren't educated. You know, they don't have the education like Dr. Carlstrom or Melody have. I'm not really an educated guy. I don't have a college degree. But those people need to be able to produce, to own their own homes, pay taxes, and receive the benefits of community, and we're losing that.
I think the other term that's very important is being awake. You say you're not an educated guy. Well, you're awake, and you're paying attention, and you're reading, and you're learning, and you're interacting. This is what we need. We need citizens in this country rather than simply consumers. We need citizens who are awake and who understand that, you know, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, like Ben Franklin said.
Right. Right, good, very good. Yeah, you know, and it gets down to even the northern migration of these uneducated people from Mexico. This is no accident. This is one of the biggest inhumane things I've ever seen that our government approves of, and it's orchestrated by the government of Mexico. And it's tragic. And then when they come to the United States, there's all different issues, from the crime to the diseases to the burden they put on our welfare systems, ERs closing, you know, across the board. You know, if through Reaganomics or through Reagan and Charlie Wilson's war and a number of things, you know, we could economically impact the United Nations, you can't tell me we can't put the pressure on Mexico to start doing the right thing with these people, these uneducated people, and start taking care of their own. NAFTA was just a disaster for the poor people, the agriculturalists of Mexico.
Bruce, you had agreed to come on the program for an hour, and it's getting to that point. Did you want to continue on? We can, you know, we're more than happy to have you go, or if you need to, you know, call
well,
it a night.
That would be fine. I didn't want to hog the program.
No. This is what you're here for.
Do people get to call into the program? Do you guys have that ability?
No, we don't. Not at this point. That maybe somewhere down the road, but at this point in time, when we're making these calls, then that pretty much ties up the line that we would be getting callers. So at this point in time, we don't have that.
It would be really great if there's some way we could monitor the response of your listeners and get them involved. And I think that's what you two are actively doing. Am I correct?
Well, we're certainly trying to get the information out there to them, and what they do with it from that point, I don't know. I mean, because, like in my case, I'm working on multiple avenues, and I know that Dr. Carlstrom is, although they're somewhat
different. I think it's a very good idea, Melody. I would love to see a call-in segment for at least the last half hour of a two-hour program. So far, technologically, you know, we've been swimming upstream the whole time because it's all new to us.
Right. Okay.
But I hope that this can be added.
Okay, no, that's definitely, I definitely was planning on looking at it. But I need to say this is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And our program is supported by, for Truth Quest, is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Okay, we go back to our discussion here, Bruce. One thing I wanted to ask a question about is, you know, there has been thousands and thousands of permits that have been granted for drilling of natural gas. I hear that they're not really doing so much drilling for oil in this country, or at least that's what they've been saying. But they're drilling for gas, and then they're capping it off. And my question here is, if these resources and parks and that sort are possibly put in collateral for the debt, then that would make sense to me why they're capping these wells off, because then they have them counted and they have a valuation put on them.
And it goes back to a sovereign wealth fund. Who owns the company that did the drilling? Who owns the company that it could be a shill company, but who is behind all this that benefits in the end? That's a great observation, Melody.
And as far as
I'm sorry, Melody, I can barely hear you. could you speak up and make that point again? Because I am very much interested in this issue, and I'm just reading a book now called High Noon for Natural Gas, the New Energy Crisis by Julian Darley. But can you make that question again?
Okay. We are in the state of Colorado, particularly on the western slope, there's been thousands of gas wells drilled and thousands of permits applied for, and what they're doing is they're capping these wells off. And what they, when asked about this, I'm given the answers that, you know, this is for, you know, down the road. But as I would see it, if they're using our resources for collateral for our national debt, then there's a valuation put on those capped wells.
And the question with the drilling is, as we saw at the Otero Mesa here, when they drill down in, they water comes up and the water is contaminated. Are they containing the water, or are they just releasing it into the stream like they did over by Gunnison? Or by parachute,
I believe. Is this happening in your area? Is that what I do?
I'm sorry?
No, he's talking about parachute.
We had a situation where they were drilling for natural gas on the Otero Mesa in Otero County.
Oh, okay.
And they didn't double wall the wells, and they just left the water, instead of containing the water in lined ponds, they just let it flow out into the mesa, and it killed everything. And then the driller packed up and left.
Okay, I guess I need to get educated about this, because I thought there had been a move to save Otero Mesa and that this was accomplished, but apparently... Otero Mesa was saved after it was destroyed, is that right?
Substantial damage was done to it. I forget the name of the ranch it was done on, by an independent driller from Texas. And I don't believe they're drilling up there now. That's an example of the environmental damage that can be done with the natural gas drilling. If you can, now, Melody had directed me to a link where I saw pictures of the Baca. I believe am I correct, Doctor? Beautiful area.
Yeah.
I mean,
if they
sink those wells and they bring up this water that's contaminated with the gas, it's going to kill that area. But someone's going to make billions of dollars off that and then move on.
Okay, just to get the facts again, there was a Texas company that did some drilling for gas on Otero Mesa. They hit gas, which polluted the water. Perhaps the wells themselves were broken, is that right? And then the polluted water came out on the surface?
Right. Yeah, he didn't double wall the... I'm not an expert on drilling, but the way it was explained to me is that they, when they case those wells, they double wall them with cement. And it costs about $200,000 a well to do that. This guy didn't want to spend the money, and the local ranchers and the environment paid the price for that. And you've got to dig a pit and line the pit somehow with either plastic or some sort of Cretaceous clay or something. I'm not quite sure how they did it. Or cement, I'm not quite sure. Contain that water, and then somehow you clean the water or something. There's a way to get the gas out of the water. That was never done. It was just pumped and out onto the land, let it run down the road or something of that nature. I'm not real clear on that. I just know that the damage was done in the search for natural gas. I'm not opposed at all to drilling for gas or for petroleum products in the United States or offshore, as long as it's done wisely and environmentally sound. We do have the technology to do it better than we did 20, 40 years ago. But like Melody said...
the fact is that there are accidents in the gas industry every day. And that, for instance, in Colorado, where there's a huge gas boom going on right now, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which is the entity that works for the state, that issues the permits, they know this very well, and they're the ones responsible for monitoring the wells and for fining the companies that have the accidents.
And I believe, does not the state of Colorado pay a subsidy to these oil companies?
They do, and they don't. I'm not sure about the subsidies, but they give, I think, the least severance taxes for these industries, so that the industries are making money hand over fist and not giving much at all back to the state, except for, of course, the results.
Is that the mineral impact grants? Is that
what we're talking about?
You know, Melody, I probably shouldn't have brought it up, but I just became aware that the state of Colorado was paying some sort of what I call a subsidy to these oil companies, and I thought that was crazy. And then as far as the water, anything that has to do with water in Colorado, there's not a single state agency responsible for issuing water rights or protecting water in Colorado. There's actually four. And a lot of these, it seems to me that the oil company, I don't know this, but they seem to get around that because it's the water that holds the gas down. Am I correct, Doctor? That holds it in the crevices, the rock?
Right.
And when that water comes up, okay, that water is under the authority of the state. It should be monitored by the state. And I don't know if it's done correctly or not. I don't believe it was in Otero Mesa in Otero County, New Mexico.
I believe when I was reading some information on the site that was taking place on the western slope, there was a driller that was over there that had pulled up and moved out and had made the comment that he drilled almost 200 wells and that there had been no oversight in the whole time that they were drilling. Do you recall that, Dr. Carlstrom?
I'm sorry, Melody, could you repeat that?
There was one of the drillers over on the western slope had drilled almost 200 wells, and they had no one come in for oversight while this was taking place. And that he was packing up and taking his men with him because he didn't want to expose him anymore to some kind of chemicals they were talking about. But, of course, you know, he didn't say what they were.
Yeah, I seem to remember that, too, but I can't remember the specifics on where that was.
It would have been over kind of probably in the Rifle area. So, you were... Did this work, did it tie in with the Paragon Foundation, or is that a totally different organization from what you're doing?
I no longer volunteer for the Paragon Foundation.
Okay.
I cut up on my own. The Paragon Foundation educates people on how they can protect private property rights and act on their own, per se, without an attorney. I chose to take on more diverse issues in the Paragon Foundation. Basically, was giving me, and so I went on to basically just, you know, we parted on good terms. But I wanted to branch out more than just private property rights. I wanted to help people take on these NGOs and the fraudulent scams perpetrated by state and county governments. Someone's getting a kickback on something somewhere.
And what makes you think this?
For an attorney general, the attorney general of the state of Washington wrote this woman a letter saying they had no authority over the Columbia Land Trust. The county commissioners told her the same thing. The county sheriff told them the same thing. What would be the motivator to have a sworn official violate their oath and let a non-governmental organization flood people out of their homes, destroy the environment, and not act? What do you think would be that motivating factor?
Well, there could be a number, but I would venture to say that there could be somebody that's profiting by it, I'm sure.
Somebody's profiting by it. And that's who, you know, I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom of that.
Joan Vion did a very nice kind of analysis, saying that there's been a fundamental shift in our country over the past 5-10 years towards what they call market-based democracy, wherein you have these public-private partnerships between governments, industry, and non-governmental organizations or NGOs, and that the express purpose of these partnerships, of course, is to make money. Therefore, government then is working kind of hand in glove with the Nature Conservancy and the Sierra Club and these organizations that we all think are you know, kind of objective and our watchdog groups, but in fact they're working together, and they all have the same motive, which is to make money. Going back to that pioneer investors concept you have, this has come back to haunt us, because this, what we see now is government working for probably the same pioneer investors. We see cartels of oil, fossil fuel companies, gas companies, in partnership with government. And of course, when you have government and business working together, that kind of arrangement has been known traditionally as fascism. And so, you know, most people who aren't brain dead now can see that our government is being run as a fascist government. But I think most people are still not clear on how it functions. And that's why I think Jones' comment about this market-based democracy based on partnerships between government, industry, and NGOs is an important revelation.
Yeah, I like Joan Vion. I've read her stuff. Oh, I lost my train of thought there. Someone else talked till I remember what I was going to say.
Okay,
so going back to...
Go ahead,
Demoe.
No, you go ahead.
Well, Ted Turner is an interesting character here. You mentioned he's a major player in New Mexico, Bruce?
In the United States.
Oh, in the United States, yeah.
Yes.
Is he specifically working in New Mexico?
He owns 600,000 acres of the Vermejo Ranch in northern New Mexico. I believe he purchased 200,000 acres in the panhandle of Nebraska. That's a big chunk of land. He's got holdings elsewhere in the United States. He funds many of these foundations that direct the NGOs. The NGOs don't come up with these ideas, these agendas on their own. They are funded and directed by somebody with the money. Ron Arnold, in his book Undue Influence, describes it very well. I recommend to you and your listeners to read that book.
Okay, does that book primarily address the non-governmental organizations? Is that what you're...
Yes, that particular book does.
Because there's another one called The Cloak of Green by Elaine Dewar, D-E-W-A-R, who does that as well. It appears that a lot of these non-governmental organizations, they don't have the oversight that some of these corporations have had in the past. And so what was happening with a lot of these countries is that these non-governmental organizations would go in and appear to be doing a lot of philanthropic work. But at the same time, there would be another faction within that organization that might be doing things to undermine the very thing that many of their volunteers that would be working for those non-governmental organizations. Does that sound right with what this other person was alluding to?
Yeah, well, there was the debacle about the vaccines in Africa. The World Health Organization was vaccinating women in Africa in the 1990s, and they discovered that the vaccine had such a high mercury content. Mercury in small amounts is used to preserve vaccines. It was sterilizing these women. The vaccine had been ordered and paid for by the United Nations.
I believe Microsoft was, or Gates was involved with that somewhat.
Who?
Bill Gates.
Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he had given money to that. I think Bush made this big deal about giving so many millions of dollars to AIDS vaccines in Africa. We paid for that tainted vaccine. It was shown that these women were sterilized by the use of this vaccine. It's such a complex, multi-head demon that's out there. It just permeates just about all aspects of the world. And I think what we're seeing is, I think what we're going to see is, and like Dr. Carlstrom was talking about, an awakening. And we're going to have to see how strong, and it's going to have to be an economic response. It can't be a violent military overthrow. It can't be like throwing the Romanovs out in 1905 and 1912. but we've got to come to grips with controlling economies, controlling markets, and controlling the world around us without falling to, you know, becoming a victim to these schemes, just like you described there.
Yeah, I was on Joan Vion's website today and looking at some of the books that she has written, and one of them is called Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince. And Joan has been to some 100 UN and other international meetings in the last 10 or 15 years and come to realize that the prime movers and shakers in this UN Agenda 21 to sustainable development, to move the world in this direction, which would be basically, you know, reducing the world to one world government with the remaining human beings being reduced to serfs and slaves. This would be Prince Charles, and Prince Charles was doesn't get much press for this, but he was having these major power meetings before the 1992 Real Earth Summit with corporations and NGOs, trying to get them on board the Agenda 21 agenda to get it to go down, get this agenda to go down at Rio. And so this is all very well coordinated before these meetings. These meetings don't just materialize out of nothing. There's a script and there's an agenda that's planned for the meeting. And then, of course, this agenda then is supposed to be passed out to, you know, all the nations of the world and all the states within the nations and the cities, et cetera. Like Agenda 21, the agenda for the 21st century, is supposed to be implemented by every single country and locally in your city.
Right.
And there have been great efforts to do this.
Excellent, yeah, right.
So the reason I threw that out is because we were trying to figure out the nature of this, you know, multi-headed monster that seems to be pushing forward this global agenda, and she traces it back to the British royal family and basically the city of London and Britain.
All right, you know, the monster from Jekyll Island, another informative book.
Yeah, the creature from Jekyll Island.
The creature from Jekyll Island. You know, they talk about the Bilderberg Group, and people say, you know, that's all your conspiracy or the Council on Foreign Relations. It's a very real thing. These people want power and control, and they want us to be the fodder. You know, what greases the cogs, so to speak.
And they don't necessarily... Yeah. I mean, a lot of these things are cloaked. I mean, because they know that a lot of people are not going to give up their property. They're not going to give up their rights unless they have been guilted or convinced to do it in a way. I mean, if they're doing it nonviolently, unless they're convinced to do it in a way that they feel that they're doing something else. In other words, a lot of times, you know, I mean, it was written back in the early turn of the 19th or the 20th century with John D. Rockefeller saying that he was going to, you know, use the environment to co-opt and bring about this one world order.
Yeah, the guy that wrote the book, Thy Will Be Done. Have you ever read that book about the Rockefellers? When that came out, he sent me a copy of that book back in 95, I believe. And just a very interesting book, very depressing. Because the Rockefellers actually...
John D. Rockefeller? Yeah.
Right. I mean, just north of Grand Teton Park, between Grand Teton and Yellowstone, there's the John D. Rockefeller... something named after John D. Rockefeller between the two parks.
Yeah, Memorial Highway. I just drove it about a month ago. Yeah.
Okay.
Huge chunk of land.
Right. And it looks, you know, fairly pristine and stuff, except for the four-lane highway and the buffalo with brucellus and the surrogate species of the wolf that's killing all the ungulates and forcing populations of buffalo and wolf out into the private lands. I mean, it's a surrogate species used to expand federal jurisdiction and authority.
And so a lot of these people are unable to do anything to protect their own cattle and that sort of thing when these wild animals are forced onto their land. Is that correct?
Right. And I think what we're going to see in, like with the Yellowstone Coalition, I think we're going to see, there's two things I think we're going to see. I kind of like to look in the future and see what's going to happen. One of them is I think we're going to see powerful alliances of ranchers, environmentalists, and people with money that believe that, you know, let's put down the secular beliefs and get behind this as sovereign citizens. The other thing I think we're going to see sometime in the future is an attempt for Western states to secede from the Union and start their own nation. You know, this is my theory. You know, I'm coming up with this on my own. I don't see a trend towards that. But it makes sense if you've had enough of the corporate United States, walk out and start your own deal.
I've heard those discussions on numerous programs, but whether they ever get any get anywhere is another matter.
Well, as we see more pressure coming from, you know, collateralizing the national debt, restriction of constitutional rights, loss of sovereignty, there will be some sort of reaction. It's historical. There's going to be. We're not unique in history by any means. You know, we saw it with, the advent of Hitler in Germany, you know, prior, you know, the Kaiser, and then the disillusion with the economy and somebody promised something better. The peasant revolts fueled by the communists prior to the death of the Romanovs. Key figures that become bigger than life for romantic notions like Che Guevara, you know, a psychotic killer that's probably responsible for the death of maybe 20,000 people, but yet he's a capitalist brand today on coffee cups, T-shirts, and hats. You know, the revisionist history, the way that the truth is skewed to fit these notions that, you know, there's got to be something better, and these globalists have the idea, but at whose expense?
Let me go ahead and do one more. I need to do some underwriting here. The support for Cahen and Truth Quest brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Bruce, you were saying that you had done some research a little bit into Nestle. What did you find out about this company?
Oh, research on Nestle?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry if you misunderstood that. I was researching the document that you had sent me.
Oh, okay. All right.
I do is I take key phrases out of that document, compare it to your Colorado revised statutes.
Okay. And where at in those revised statutes were you looking?
Well, under your constitution, under the Colorado state constitution, and I'm pulling this out of memory, Article 16, Sections 5 and 6, Colorado revised statutes, I've been on them all day, 37, Articles 80 through 92. That defines your state water law. Colorado has excellent water law. Delph Carpenter, born in Colorado, died in Greeley in 1951, the father of southwestern and western water laws. You know, he had a lot to do with that. Read about Delph Carpenter. But those are that's where in your state constitution and your Colorado revised statutes you will find the articles of your water law. I apply the Nestle letter, you know, we'll get with the county commissioners and get this thing worked out to apply for permits. Okay, you're talking about water. County commissioners have no authority over that water. I want to see the preliminary science. And if there is an environmental impact statement filed, I want to see the QAP that is filed before the environmental impact statement is filed. Those are my questions in regards to that situation in Chaffee County.
And
could you give the actual law again, the Colorado State Constitution statute, and then you had some letters and numbers?
Okay, let me find my notes on this. Okay, it's your state constitution, Article 16, sections 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm.
And then in your Colorado Revised Statutes, it is section 37, articles 80 through 92.
Okay. Thank you.
And you know, the responsible agencies, if you get to that point, you'll find the responsible agencies for your water rights through these water courts. Okay, you have 7 water courts in Colorado, and each court has a water judge and a water referee who hear all water-related matters within their jurisdiction, of course. Your state engineer administers and distributes the state's waters, not the county commissioners. The state engineer is also responsible for issuing and denying permits, not the county commissioners. The state engineer is responsible for permits for constructing wells, diverting groundwater, but the permit does not constitute rights to the water because Colorado is a prior appropriation state. That means first in time, first in right to water. New Mexico is a prior appropriation state. So it's very important that when a big corporation like Nestle comes in and says, we're only going to take 200 cubic feet of water off the river a year, look at that, see what their preliminary science is, find the QAPP, it's QAPP, I forget what it stands for. Melody, if I can find my copy of it, I'll get you a copy of it.
Okay.
I'll email it to you. That document is filed before an environmental impact statement is filed. Those are public documents. You want to see that, you want to see the environmental impact statement, and you want to challenge Nestle's preliminary science. Anytime I see stuff like that, you know, red flags go up for me.
Well, you know, I don't really have a problem with, you know, as a rule that some company own, you know, a spring or something of that sort. But what I'm really seeing, and when I start researching water privatization around the world, we're finding out that these companies are coming in and trying to, they have a tendency to kind of take over, and they'll tell you anything when they initially get in to get their way, and then after that, you know, if they do something that the people don't like, it's just like, sue me.
Well, he concludes his letter, and I'm reading from something now. Bruce Lauerman, the Natural Resources Manager for Nestle's Water North America, he says, we will continue working with stakeholders, including neighbors, regulators, local leaders, to determine how our project can be improved to best meet the needs of the community. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I want to see that deal. I want to be on that wagon when that thing pulls out of the barn.
And why do you say that?
Well, including neighbors, regulators, and local leaders. Who are the regulators? The county commissioners? There's nothing in this text of this document that he put in the paper that alludes to Colorado water law, to the water courts, to the seven districts that the waters, you know, nothing, nothing. It's just that we'll submit the permits to the county commissioners and everything's good. Actually, applications to Chaffee County soon. Doesn't really mention the commissioners. I'm assuming he means the county commissioners. And this is a county commission. This is a county that has an ordinance on there called Right to Ranch. And that's a very detailed document and county ordinance enforcing county law to protect ranching, the environment, and to mitigate disputes. It's a novel piece of county ordinance. I'm thinking about doing one for Otero County down here, something similar to that. A county that writes something like that probably isn't going to be swayed by Nestle's. And like, we want the headwaters of the major river that goes through Chaffee County, which is the Arkansas. Am I correct?
Right.
Yes.
And I see this, I'm saying, well, what if they want the headwaters of this river? What if they want control of that flow? Has that ever occurred to anybody?
I mean, it's occurred to me, but I couldn't imagine how they would go about it, and I'm not familiar with any instances.
We have a situation here in Catron County and Sierra County, New Mexico. No, it's Catron and Luna County, I believe. the Central Arizona Project gets water from the last two wild rivers in New Mexico, the Gila and the San Francisco. And part of the water from those rivers, a portion of that water is diverted to a pipe, and it goes into Arizona. Arizona wants to build dams on those last two wild rivers in New Mexico, dam them up to provide more water for the Indian reservations in Arizona, and pipe that water all the way to Tucson. Governor Richardson wisely, you know, for the time being, he says, no, we don't want to do that. CAP is going ahead and proceeding with that. Now, Catron County is where they've introduced the Mexican gray wolf, which is another issue, and devastated ranching there. You ask, how would they do that? Well, here's a situation where an out-of-state entity has all of a sudden said, we're going to put dams on your last two wild rivers so we can provide water to Tucson and the Indian reservations. You have a obligation to provide the Native American populations with water. No, the state of New Mexico has an obligation to provide water for the tribes within the sovereign boundaries of New Mexico, not in Arizona. And that's a manipulation of law and belief. And, of course, a lot of people jump on that. When I talked to people from Catron County, I said, were you aware that these dams are being contemplated? They said, no. And the first thing they thought about was tourist dollars, water skiing, cabins on the lake. I don't think that's going to happen. I think with the critical habitat created for this surrogate species and this fictional litigation of junk science of how we need to bring the Mexican wolf back, they're not going to be allowed to create a tourist industry on any lake they form in those canyons to provide water for Tucson. I just don't see that happening.
Well, I kind of find that interesting, because a lot of the information that I'd been reading was where they were wanting to get rid of these dams to go have the rivers go back to the wild. Have you run across
In Nevada and Colorado, or on the Colorado River?
Not in any particular state. It just had more to do with the wilding of America.
Right. Yeah. I'm sorry. I've got that somewhere in my pile of stuff. I call this the media center, this room I'm in. It looks more like a secondhand bookstore than a place to study. But I've got that somewhere. Becky Waters is the president of American Rivers.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that organization?
No, I'm not.
Okay, American Rivers has been cast as kind of a radical environmental organization. They're really not. It's a pretty sane approach to saving America's rivers with taking into consideration communities. The reason I mentioned Becky Waters, because I went to high school with her in Omaha, Nebraska. I think she still has my Magic Christian cassette tape, you know, Bad Finger. But anyway, to go on with the discussion here, there are ways to, and Dr. Carlstrom alluded to this, you know, you can put a facade on something, say this is what we're doing, and Melody, you alluded to it too. Something completely different is going on. I have a hard time understanding how they allocated all this land as critical habitat in the Apache and Gila National Forest in Catron County on the Arizona-New Mexico border, and yet they're going to put it all underwater to provide water for Tucson. It just doesn't jive, you know. And so the confusion is there. So what they do with the critical habitat for the Mexican gray wolf is they move that east in Sierra County, Otero County, up north to McKinley County. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. So in other words, they just use the cause for whatever they need to implement? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Okay.
Well, Bruce, since your state, New Mexico, and my state, Colorado, especially the southern part of Colorado, have something very important in common, and that's the Rio Grande River. Do you get your drinking water from the Rio Grande? Or I know most people in New Mexico probably do.
I get my drinking water from a windmill in a parking lot of a grocery store up the street here. You know? No.
Well, let me talk about the Rio Grande. It heads up in the San Juan Mountains, fairly close to where we are here in the San Luis Valley. And the San Luis Valley is, depending on who you talk to, considered part of the headwaters of the Rio Grande. It was connected to the Rio Grande for most of the past 5 million years because we had this huge lake here between about 5 million years ago and about 450,000 years ago. So obviously that lake drained down into the Rio Grande. Now that lake is mostly gone, it drained about 450,000 years ago, and we're left, that lake was called Lake Alamosa. Now what we have is a huge reservoir of water under the San Luis Valley, and of course that would be affected, could be affected by the gas drilling of the Lexan company, which is a Canadian company that wants to drill 3 14,000-foot gas exploration wells here. One of the reasons that we started Water Watch Alliance was we realized that the value of the water, any potential water here, could be in the many billions, as opposed, and maybe even trillions, depending on how, where you sell that water, as opposed to the value of natural gas, which would be, you know, much, much less. But it could still run in the low billions if they did get what they want, which is a trillion cubic feet of natural gas. But speaking of the Rio Grande, the Rio Grande starts here, goes down through New Mexico, travels 2,000 miles to the Gulf of Mexico. 10 million people depend on it in a very arid region, so this is the most litigated river in America. And what I've been concerned about or curious about is that the people of New Mexico have not been interested in this issue. I've called some of the water districts down around Albuquerque, you know, those guys say, well, you know, it's just not a problem because the Rio Grande Compact of 1938 guarantees that Colorado is going to deliver a certain amount of water to New Mexico through, and sometimes we use irrigation ditches and a canal that's been built here to get the appropriated amount. So they figure it's not their problem, it's Colorado's problem to deliver the water to them. And the Colorado Water District people here don't seem to be concerned about the potential impacts of pollution on this gigantic pool of water. You know, some people estimate that it may be one of the largest left aquifers, underground reservoirs of water that are still clean.
That's separate from the Oglala aquifer, correct?
Yeah, this is different from the Ogallala. The Ogallala is east of the Front Range, and it's going out to Kansas and Texas, and all the way up to all the way up to South Dakota. So that's bigger. But this is we've got about 14,000-15,000 feet of alluvial sediments in this valley, and water, and it's mostly sand and gravel and fairly porous stuff. The upper 2,000 feet of the aquifer here are thought to be potable. And of course, that water would be extremely valuable in the future as there are, you know, there's water shortages, et cetera. But so what I'm wondering is how do we kind of get connected with some people in New Mexico, maybe through this Otero resident?
We just did it by you telling me that. You and I will correspond, and we'll get that news out. It's interesting because one of the things that we don't get our water from the Rio Grande. The Rio Grande goes to the west and south of us. But the transboundary water treaties that are being negotiated now with water from the Rio Grande and the Pecos to send water to Mexico. And this thing was set up by the University of Texas and some guys from Mexico. I don't remember a vote on that.
Yeah,
and they want to obligate the United States to that. I'm sorry?
Yeah. Pardon me?
I was talking about this transboundary water treaty they want to have with Mexico down here.
And I'm not familiar that much with that. Can you tell me anything about that?
Well, the thing is in the initial stages right now where they would provide water. I think back in 1968 or 1980, there was a treaty where we would provide Mexico with water. And we would desalinate the water, pump it out of the ground, and provide it to Mexico. So many cubic feet a year, and then they would return that water through a pipeline. The pipeline exists. We sent them the trashiest water we could. It made people sick in Mexico. People died. It killed crops. It just almost, dehabitated a part of northeastern, or part of Chihuahua, anyway. I don't know if you've ever driven around Mexico and stuff, but there's not a lot growing down there. They say it's because of the water they got from the United States. Mexico never returned that water. So as a way to make up for that, these transboundary water treaties are being negotiated with the blessing of along with the transboundary water treaty comes a biosphere as designated by UNESCO. Okay, and this is to bring better water to the people of Mexico, this humanitarian effort that we kind of skunked them on 20 some years ago. It takes water from a very populated area and sends it to a very unpopulated area where people probably aren't going to do well anyway. I don't know if you've been to the Sonora and Chihuahua and those areas down there. There's a lot of people there, but yeah, they don't do a lot with the land.
Yeah.
It's a very impoverished area.
The Rio Grande Compact of 1938 does supply drinking water for the states of Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and Mexico. And if you look at the map, you see that two-thirds of the Rio Grande River goes along the border between Texas and Mexico. And so, as you say, the traditional approach has been that Mexico gets the most saline water. But this is an extremely important river for each of these, well, especially New Mexico and Texas, as well as Mexico. And it's the second longest river in the United States, and it's in a semi-arid region, so it's extremely valuable water.
And there's a big demand on that water, too. There's less and less water comes out of that river by the time it gets down to El Paso every year. I mean, Doctor, I can't tell you how many years ago it was, but I drove across the river into Mexico one day with some buddies of mine to get lunch, and we came back the same way. There's not a lot of water running through that river at certain times of the year.
Yeah, it's over allocated, and of course the downstream users get what's left. And Mexico has gotten salty water, which is unpotable. You mentioned some desalinization plants, etc. So I'll be very interested in looking into this transboundary water treaty with Mexico, because I now that I think about it, I have heard something about that to the effect that Mexico is still going to get the short end, but I'll be interested to look into that. But again, we're the upper Rio Grande River. This is where the river starts, and it's where it's the clearest and purest. And we're supposed to give a certain allotment every year to New Mexico, and then New Mexico is supposed to give a certain allotment every year to Texas, which is held in Elephant Butte Reservoir, I believe. And then Texas, of course, is supposed to share it with Mexico. But it seems to me that as we put these gas and oil wells into these aquifers and we jeopardize the quality of that water for future generations, we're thinking short term, and we're penalizing future generations quite potentially.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And that's an excellent example of an international treaty, so to speak, that no one's going to win by. And then if it's already under this biosphere, the biosphere is going to have dehabitation agendas, surrogate species agendas, like the Mexican spotted owl. That's a scam. And the rural people, and probably the urbanites too, like El Paso and Las Cruces, Juarez, is a great big urban area. Those will have to go. That will have to disappear. Have you ever been down to this part of the country?
Yes, I have, but years ago.
But
yeah,
El Paso.
Well, yeah, I was down in southern New Mexico in the fall, a beautiful area. Are you talking about Mexico now?
Well, I'm talking about that big area, that big population of people on your side of the border.
Yeah, I have been down to Chihuahua. Yeah, it's you're saying it's going to have to go?
If the entire area falls under a biosphere and they're not going to have access to water or using the water, a number of things, as I've seen with the agendas pressed in Africa, I think that would be the desired goal, to depopulate that area, a population shift, as seen in Agenda 21 or the Law of the Sea Treaty or the 1992 Rio conference, you know, where they...
We're talking potentially of several million people or at least a couple million people here, right?
Right, right. Reduce these populations.
And you suppose would be... Well, where would they be put? Where would they go?
They would go either to population areas designated to hold these people, or they would die off. They would somehow attrit the population, probably from lack of water or something. I mean, we're seeing it in Africa. We're seeing it in Brazil.
Yeah.
You know, before we get too much...
Yeah, I suppose we should mention that the people like Joan Vion and others who have been attending these UN meetings that talk about the meetings where the main agenda item is depopulation of the world, with the kind of the unproven assumption that there are too many people in the world, that we're using up all the resources, that in order to be fair to future generations, we need to bring the population of the world down from about 6.5 billion down to, you know, 1 or 2 billion. In other words, depopulate the world by 4 billion or 5 billion in the next 50 years.
Right.
This is not a warm and fuzzy agenda. I think people need to realize that this is a diabolical and draconian notion, and is probably not supported by science. It's an example of science being politicized to justify a political agenda, probably by these pioneer investors that you mentioned founded the UN.
Well, you know, when you talk about science and these political, and I say political agendas and stuff, if you look at the time of Stalin, where they had the party philosophers advising the scientists what was...
Melody, are you there?
Yes, I am.
No, we didn't mean to cut you out.
Oh, no, I'm listening.
But during the time of Stalin, prior to Stalin taking power, the Soviets, or the Russian physicists, were involved in exchange with the institutions of education in Europe and the United States. And they were trying to build their, you know, study the physics and advance Russia, you know, to become an economic power and stuff. Well, Stalin, when the communists took power, he put party philosophers in there that told the scientists what was good science and what was not. And this is the best thing for the party, not for the people and not for the world, so to speak.
So in other words, you're saying that sometimes science is really kind of dictated to by the politics.
Correct.
Okay. That makes sense. Because I keep encountering that a lot in some of the research that I'm doing these days, where there's such a split between the scientists, and they seem to be polarized to like two different arguments. It's not, you know, many arguments. It seems to me like it's one way or the other way, and it seems to be very politicized in the process.
Yeah, I think the debate over global warming, climate change, carbon offsets, carbon banks, Al Gore, you know, that's all a good example of that. I really think that's marketing. Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, you know, after 9/11, the shock doctrine is being applied to the environment, to population, to critical habitat. It's all motivated by the control of these areas, depopulating these areas. I think part of the belief is a smaller population would be better to care for itself. We wouldn't have the burden of welfare or uneducated people that can't care for themselves, and then they, in effect, can produce more, spend more, and create more of a wealth for the world overall. I think Sir Julian Huxley spoke of that In fact, his writings and that book are on display in the lobby of the United Nations. They make no effort to hide that.
And the book is, again?
It's the original charter.
Oh, okay.
With his writings in it. I don't think you can get it on Amazon, but they got one.
Well, it seems to me like the Huxleys had been into eugenics for many generations. Am I correct?
Right. Prior to... Well, you know, the... I think it was in 1948, 1949, they came out with a 10-volume exposé on education. And in 1920s, they referenced a woman, I forget her name, who had written, she was an atheist and a globalist and wanted to see one world government, and she was influential with the NEA, the National Education Association. It says in that 10-volume set that...
It wasn't Margaret Sanger, was it?
No.
Okay.
No. I've got it on around here somewhere, Melody. Like I say, okay. It's in the piles. I'll get it to you. You need to write down everything I say. I'm going to get to you. Anyway, she wanted to get the child at a very young age and educate the child, indoctrinate the child to a global government, to refute the parental authority, to reject religion, to reject spirituality, only to have the spirituality of the globalist, and to do away with the nasty specter of nationalism, to do away with constitutional beliefs, patriotism, and pride in being an American or pride in being a Briton. And that's in that 10-volume study they did on education. And that was part of what UNESCO, in the UNESCO charter, that 10-volume deal is included in that.
So in other words, you're saying that they're utilizing a lot of different terminology to implement a socialistic regime through many levels of our society, through education, taking away of private property rights, and doing it under the auspices of things like the environment or wilding or that sort, so that they can implement their new government or one world governments.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and Bruce, I really want to thank you for coming on our program tonight. And although it took a little getting started there, I'm glad you hung in there. And thank you, Eric, again for graciously coming on our program and co-hosting. And I hope it'll be soon that we'll have you back on. And again, thank you, Bruce.
Well, thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it. I'd like to do it again. And let's exchange. You've got my email, Doctor. Let's exchange correspondence so I can catch up on what we need to exchange as far as information, because you enlightened me to some stuff I wasn't aware of.
Are you there, Eric? Maybe we lost him. Okay. All right. Well, Bruce, again, I want to thank you. And next coming up is going to be... oh, my goodness, I forgot. Joe Frank. And so I'll have to say again, good night.
Okay. Thanks, Melody.
Uh-huh. Bye. Bye. Good night, Eric.